Okay, how's this? Is that good enough? Okay, shall I begin? Shall I begin now? Okay, here we go. The Poetry Center of San Francisco State is proud to present Mr. Merwin in a reading of his own poems. Mr. Merwin is certainly one of the brightest lights in the field of American poetry, the recipient of numerous grants and fellowships awarded in recognition of his very impressive achievement. He is the author of 4 books of verse, as well as of several plays and of translations from the Romance languages. His work is elegant, marked by formal mastery of his materials. And this elegance is combined with a genuine awareness of the darkest and deepest areas in human experience. I'm pleased indeed to present Mr. Merwin.
Very much. I'm going to make no attempt to be what's known as representative. I'm going to try not to repeat too monotonously what I read this morning, and at the same time read what I feel like reading. And I think unless you've reached the point. Any writer, unless he's reached the point of such total despair that he wants to stop writing and think no more about it, would probably rather read more recent work than earlier work. And I'm going to let the implications fall where they may and do just that. I warn anybody who happened to be there this morning that there are bound to be certain repetitions. And there's nothing I can do about that. The poems haven't changed in the meantime. But what I am going to do is confine the reading entirely, unless there's any particular request to the contrary, to the last published collection, which is called The Drunk in the Furnace, and then to poems written largely within the last year, more recent ones, which have not yet been, poems written within the last year, which have not yet been published in a volume. And I'm going to start off this evening with a poem which seems to have bear a strange relation to action rather than writing that I've done since. It was, I suppose, ticked off by an essay of Montaigne's, which I read about 15 years ago, called The Parthian's Arms, in which Montaigne makes the point that when people go out to battle, Montaigne, as you remember, has got a very marvelously inconclusive way of writing, and he'll pile up his examples one direction, then he'll pile them up on the other, and then he'll pretend to leave the decision to you, but he's made up his mind before he ever started the essay, usually. He had in this case, too. He said that it's a short essay, and he says, isn't it interesting that when some people go out to fight, they put on as much armor as they can stagger under, and they carry as many arms as the horse will carry, and they go generally accoutred to pieces. And then when other people go out, they wear nothing but what's absolutely necessary for decency, and they carry nothing but a sling maybe and a few stones, and yet their results seem to be just about the same. The poem is called Choice of Prides. To tell the truth, it would have its points, since fall we must, to do it proud, to ride for your fall on a good mount, hung with honors and looped garlands, moved by the crowd's flattering sounds, or to advance with brash din, banners, flights of arrows leaping like hounds. But from a choice of prides, I would pick, or so I hope, the bare cheek to amble out, innocent of arms and alone, under the cocked guns or what missiles might be in season. And this in the pure brass of the act attired, and in no other armor. considering that of every species, I should reason, mine is most naked, for all its draperies enacting as a pink beast its honest nature, I will take in this raw condition what pride I can, not have my boast in glad rags, my bravery plated. And I should think myself twice lucky, stuck with my choice, if I could be sure that I had been egged on by nothing but neat pride, and not, as is common, brought to it by the veiled promptings of vanity, or by poverty, or the fecklessness of despair. I was asked about that poem, whether that was a deliberate apologia, a private apologia for pacifism, and indeed it wasn't, because I'm far closer to pacifism now than I was when I wrote it. I hadn't thought much about it at the time. But obviously it was about the whatever there is in oneself that is liable to eventually come to such a position. That particular kind of ambiguity of not knowing what position you're liable later to come to, I'm reminded of in the next poem which I'm going to read, which is the title poem of this collection, and called The Drunk in the Furnace. I was asked about this one this morning, and I was asked something which I haven't yet had a chance to think much about, and I'm not sure that I know the answer, whether this was a reversal of Plato's cave and some... But I don't know whether that's true or not, but I do know that the nearest analog that I can think of to it is not a question of stature, but of kind, is Brecht's Mother Courage. He made this figure, apparently, well, before I say that, I'll say that she was this character was a camp follower in the Hundred Years' War, and the play covers about a generation in which she follows the armies around and preys on the circumstances, and whatever the circumstances are, she survives. And one comes to the conclusion that eventually the virtues of endurance are real virtues. They're not simply cynical virtues, and that this is, I finished the play with the feeling that this was one of the great characters in modern fiction, and was surprised later on to find out that Brecht had deliberately created her as an image of all that was contemptible and all that he despised, and hoped that this would be obvious to anybody who read the play. This, too, is a poem about survival, which leaves the question of good and evil fairly ambiguous. At least, I think it does. And someone asked me this evening, too, who they referred to. It refers, in case there's any confusion, to the locality, about which I'd better make a couple explanatory remarks. It's the Allegheny Valley, about 60 miles north of Pittsburgh, biologically dead, a place of slag heaps, which was once beautiful country, where the streams run so nearly purely sulfur that you can see the yellow stains right down where they run, even when they dry up in the summer. Where prosperity, insofar as it ever hit the country, hit it only for about 5 or 10 years, and most of the industrial piles are long since abandoned. The people who still live there live in tar paper shacks and secondhand trailers. But it's a country that believes in its own virtues powerfully, and is so the particular county that I'm thinking of, have in mind here, is so dry that there's been question about even whether it was legal to sell buttermilk, because buttermilk, if you kept it long enough, was able to get up to 3% alcohol in it. The title of the poem is The Drunk in the Furnace. For a good decade, the furnace stood in the naked gully, fireless and vacant as any hat. Then, when it was no more to them than a hulking black fossil, we rode unnoticed with the rest of the junk hill by the poisonous creek, and rapidly to be added to their ignorance. They were afterwards astonished to confirm one morning a twist of smoke like a pale resurrection staggering out of its chewed hole, and to remark then other tokens that someone cozily bolted behind the eye-holed iron door of the drafty burner, had there established his bad castle. Where he gets his spirits, it's a mystery, but the stuff keeps him musical, hammer and anviling with poker and bottle to his jugged bellowings, to the last groaning clang as he collapses onto the rioting springs of a litter of car seats ranged on the grates, to sleep like an iron pig. In their tar-papered church, on a text about stokeholes that are sated never, their reverend lingers. They nod and hate trespassers. When the furnace wakes, though, all afternoon their witless offspring flock like piped rats to its siren crescendo and agape on the crumbling ridge, stand in a row and learn. I'll jump back from the end of that collection to a poem on a theme about departure and about a composite character which introduces it, and which is earlier by about 3 years than that last poem. It's also about a character who's ostensibly much further away in both time and place. In fact, out of Greek mythology, but who's always been written about, and the many times that he has been written about, for some private reason, I think, except possibly for the first time. He ties in with some later poems about people that I mean to read, and I hope to explain the connection to some degree. It's called Odysseus. Always the setting forth was the same. Same sea. Same dangers waiting for him, as though he had got nowhere but older. Behind him, on the receding shore, the identical reproaches, and somewhere out before him, the unraveling patience he was wedded to. There were the islands, each with its woman and twining welcome to be navigated, and one to call home. The knowledge of all that he betrayed grew till it was the same whether he stayed or went. Therefore he went. And what wonder if sometimes he could not remember which was the one who wished on his departure perils that he could never sail through, and which, improbable, remote, and true, was the one he kept sailing home to. There are a number of poems about the sea in this collection. And I think I'll read one which is a sort of counterpiece to the Odysseus one. I had in mind the New England coast and the opposite. I mean, all this stuff about departure is a sort of string to tie a lot of things onto. You have to have something. But I find that there are a number of these poems which have got opposites. And they seem to work in the same way. I mean, there's Odysseus and there's this one, and they'll be the same sort of play back and forth that I mean to do about twice more. This is pure accident, looking back over them. I didn't write them with this in mind. This poem is called Sea Wife. There must be so many souls washing up and down out there just out of sight. You would think the sea would be full. One day it will surely be full and no more sea. We will not live to see it. You can see that the eyes of fish used to staring at souls can never believe us, standing up and breathing air. So much the sea changes things. Husbands, maybe you never know, but sons, fathers, above all brothers, they are fished from us and gone in the holds of boats, and only strangers come into us from the sea, even if sometimes they be the same strangers, or else their names sounding like strangers on the church wall. Us too it changes. Just with hating it, our eyes take on its distance and our hair its blowing whiteness. But we are the same here with God and the bells. And the boats, maybe they are the same when we see them, but we were never close to them, They were always untouchable, as though in bottles. Do not learn it from us. The bells are old and impartial and upright and will tell you, beyond the last Channel Nun and the Cape Horn, God is not righteous. Doom calls like women. The fish wait for friends. God is our rock here in his goodness. The bells tell where he is. They tell of his righteousness, and they moan seaward, mourning for the souls that are lost there. I don't know who's speaking that poem. But she comes, I imagine, from a mixture of my grandmother, whom I'll talk about in a minute, and the New England coast, which I knew imperfectly and still know imperfectly, but knew even more so at the time. But whoever it is obviously in some way connected in my own mind with a woman in another poem, which I'll read now, who was referred to by a guy who wrote a thing apropos me in something that I saw this last winter, who said that really the interesting thing was that all the years I've been writing prose, and I only started writing poetry when I came home and started writing about Pennsylvania. And the instance that he cited was this next poem, which I'm going to read, which is about a woman walking through the red light district of London. I don't know whose point that proves, but it seemed to me that I wish he'd made his reference plainer before he sort of based his whole thing on it. The Swallow Street, since he lived in the place, he should have known, is a block from Piccadilly, in the place where furs mean only one thing. And they mean it in this poem. The woman did indeed remind me of an aunt of mine, but he wasn't to have known that. The title of the poem is Small Woman on Swallow Street. 4 feet up under the bruised blue-fingered hat felt, the eyes begin. The sly brim slips over the sky, street after street, and nobody knows to stop it. It will cover the whole world if there is time. 50 years start in gray, the eyes have. You will never catch up to where they are, too clever and always walking. The legs not long, but the boots big, with wide smiles of darkness going round and round at their tops, climbing. They are almost to the knees already, where there should have been ankles to stop them. So must keep walking all the time. Hurry, for the Black Sea is down where the toes are and swallows all. A big coat can help save you, but eyes push you down. Never meet eyes. There are hands and hands, and love follows its furs into shut doors. Who shall be killed first? Do not look up there. The wind is blowing the building tops, and a hand is sneaking the whole sky another way, but it will not escape. Do not look up. God is on high. He can see you. You will die. It may be fairly obvious from that either the woman or the person who wrote the poem or both of them had some Puritan ancestry somewhere. I sort of have it fairly strong, alas. And my grandfather, who was a Welsh enigma, and managed to escape it in his own way. His father had been shot running for political office in Western Pennsylvania when he was out shopping for coffee in a pillow sack. And he himself was a river pilot on the Allegheny, and in the neighborhood, he was locally famous as a drunk. I was only allowed to meet him on one occasion. We spent a very fine afternoon together, in which he told me all about how tomatoes had once been poisonous and indeed, treated me as though I were an old gentleman from Kentucky. So I feel very strongly on the subject. He was apparently a very good pilot, and managed to separate his piloting and his drunkenness. He was also a very neat and careful drunk, and also a very neat and careful shot with a pistol, which he always carried and believed in never using on human beings. But they never were quite sure about this, and apparently he never got in a fight in his life. When he was an old man, his numerous progeny shut him up in an old men's home and then patted themselves on the back for having done it. This is something that I've yet to live down. I may say that my grandmother kept the Puritan tradition flying like a scarf, and it was Methodist in her case, and they didn't see eye to eye on that either, and separated after seven children had been born. But the poem is called Grandfather in the Old Men's Home. Gentle at last, and as clean as ever, he did not even need drink anymore. And his good sons unbent and brought him tobacco to chew both times when they came to be satisfied he was well cared for. And he smiled all the time to remember grandmother, his wife, wearing the true faith like an iron nightgown, yet brought to birth seven times, and raising the family through her needle's eye, while he got away down the Green River, finding directions for boats. And himself coming home sometimes, well healed but blind drunk, to hide all the bread and shoot holes in the bucket while he made his daughters pump. Still smiled as kindly in his sleep beside the other clean old men to see grandmother every night the same, huge in her age, with her thumbs down mouth come hating the river, filling with her stare his gliding dream, while he turned to water. While the children they both had begotten, with old faces now, but themselves shrunken to child size again, stood ranged at her side, beating their little Bibles till he died. The Sea Wife poem was a sort of compliment to the Odysseus one, the obvious compliment to one about my grandfather, sort of trying to state his point, is one about my grandmother trying as far as possible, I suppose, to state hers. She had remarkable contradictions. She believed that Southerners practically inevitably went to hell. And the war that she referred to always was the Civil War. She always voted Republican, and yet she was one of the first people in Western Pennsylvania who gave her cellars gave her cellar to John L. Lewis to have a meeting in. She remained a Methodist of such vehemence and conviction that when my father turned Presbyterian, she spent 10 years wondering about whether or not he could get into heaven or not. But the geographical point which I should make before reading this poem is simply one about the Allegheny Valley, which, in case anyone has never been there, the Allegheny is a wide river, and the banks are very steep and quite high. So that when there's a flood there, it's likely to be sudden and disastrous, as was the case with Johnstown when the dam broke on a similar river just a little bit to the east. Everything runs parallel to the river because of this. There's the river itself, the railroad tracks, which usually run right along it, the road, and then the town will run parallel with these. And she had known four such towns of different sizes, but all laid out the same way. First was the hamlet where she was born. The next was the village which she married into. And the third was the town down the river, which she moved to when she separated from my grandfather, and finally the city which she moved to and eventually died in. But they all had this one thing in common, and I'm assuming that there were moments when she was looking out of her window as a very old woman, she lived to be nearly 100, when they would all seem to be hard to tell apart. The poem is simply called Grandmother Watching at Her Window. There was always the river or the train right past the door, and someone might be gone come morning. When I was a child, I mind being held up at a gate to wave goodbye, goodbye to I didn't know who, gone to the war, and how I cried after. When I married, I did what was right, but I knew even that first night that he would go, and so shut my soul tight behind my mouth so he could not steal it when he went. I brought the children up clean with my needle, taught them that stealing is the worst sin, knew if I loved them they would be taken away, and did my best, but must have loved them anyway, for they slipped through my fingers like stitches. Because God loves us always, whatever we do. You can sit all your life in churches and teach your hands to clutch when you pray and never weaken, but God loves you so dearly just as you are that nothing you are can stay. But all the time you keep going away, away. I'm going to read one last poem from this collection. It's a poem which is sort of based, I don't know where it is, on a proverb. And which is one of the last poems that was written in this collection. The proverb is, in the country of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. It's, I think, roughly about the same kind of thing that the drunk in the furnace is, or a number of these others, but I suppose the connection is not obvious, and I won't try to labor the point. It's called One Eye, with that proverb in mind. On that vacant day, after kicking and moseying here and there for some time, he lifted that carpet corner his one eyelid, and the dyed light leapt at him from all sides like dogs. Also hues that he had never heard of in that place were bleeding and playing. Even so, it was only at the grazing of light fingers over his face unannounced, and then his sight of many mat eyes, paired white irises like dried peas looking, that had dawned on him. His sidelong idling had found the country of the blind, whose swarming digits knew him at once, their king, come to them out of a saying, and chanting an anthem unto his one eye to the dry accompaniment that their leaping fingers made flicking round him like locusts in a cloud, they took him home with them. Their shapely city shines like a suit. On a plain chair he was set in a cloak of hands and crowned to intricate music. They sent him their softest daughters, clad only in scent and their own vast ears, meantime making different noises in each antechamber. They can be wakened sometimes by a feather falling on the next floor, and they keep time by the water clocks dropping even when they sleep. Once he would expound to them all from his only light, day breaking, the sky spiked and the earth amuck with color, and they would listen, amazed at his royalty, gaping like sockets, and would agree, blank as pearls, at the beginning. Alone in brightness, soon he spoke of it in sleep only. Look, look, he would call out, in the dark only. Now in summer, gaudy with birds, he says nothing. Of their thefts often beheld, and their beauties, now for a long time, nothing. Nothing day after day to see the black thumb as big as a valley over their heads descending silently out of a quiet sky. I probably ought to move on after I didn't think of reading that one last in that collection. The poems in this that I'll read from, now till the end of the time, are all since that collection. And I explained this morning that there was a period of about a year, about 18 months, when I not only couldn't write, but felt such disgust with everything that I had written before that I couldn't even look at it. And when I did start to write again, quite suddenly, everything came out very differently. And in order to try to make the point that there's not a complete break, I'm going to try to follow some themes, which you can pick up yourselves the connect with some of the poems that I've been reading. The first of these, and many of these will be the same that I read this morning, the first of these is a poem which has been confused with autobiography, and so I'll explain before I start. But it's really about a sourdough in Montreal whom I met in 47 when I was there for the summer. And he's presumably come back from the Yukon or wherever it was, and he's an old man and is planning to spend his, insofar as he's planning anything, he's planning to dissipate the rest of his defeat in Montreal. And the poem has got the joyous title Home for Thanksgiving, and consequently it was published in the Thanksgiving issue of a magazine. Home for Thanksgiving. I bring myself back from the streets that open like long silent laughs and the others spilled into in the way of rivers breaking up, littered with words crossed by cats and that sort of thing. From the knowing wires and the aimed windows, well, this is nice, on the third floor in back of the billboard that says now improved, and I know what they mean. I thread my way in and I sew myself in like money. Well, this is nice with my shoes moored by the bed and the lights around the billboard ticking on and off like a beacon. I have brought myself back like many another crusty, unbarbered vessel launched with a bottle from the bare regions of pure hope, where for a great part of the year it scarcely sets at all. And from the night skies regularly filled with old movies of my fingers, weightless as shadows groping in the sluices, and from the visions of veins like arteries, and from the months of plying between can and can, vacant as a pint in the morning, while my sex grew into the only tree, a joyless evergreen, and the winds played hell with it at night, coming as they did over at least 1,000 miles of emptiness, thumping as though there were nothing but doors, insisting, come out, and of course I would have frozen. Sunday, a fine day, with my ears wiped and my collar buttoned, I went for a jaunt all the way out and back on a streetcar, and under my hat, with the dent settled in the right place, I was thinking maybe, a thought which I have noticed many times like a bold rat, I should have stayed making some of those good women happy for a while at least, Vera with the eau de cologne and the small fat dog named Joy, Gladys with her earrings cooking and watery arms, the one with the limp and the fancy sheet, some of them are still there, I suppose. Oh no. I bring myself back, avoiding in silence, like a ship in a bottle. I bring my bottle. Well, there was thin pearl with the invisible hairnets. The wind would not have been right for them. They would have had their times, rugs, troubles. They would have wanted curtains, cleanings, answers. They would have produced families, their own and our own, hen friends and other considerations. My fingers sifting the dark would have turned up other poverties. I bring myself back like a mother cat transferring her only kitten, telling myself secrets through my mustache. They would have wanted to drink ship, sea, and all, or to break the bottle. Well, this is nice. Oh, misery, 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 you fit me from head to foot like a good grade suit of longies, which I've worn for years and never want to take off. I did the right thing, after all. The last of these obvious counterparts, the first of them was the Odysseus and the sea wife, and the second one was the two about my grandparents, and this is the third. And as with the case of my grandmother, this is all of the ones where the person stays behind seem to be in the first person. I don't quite understand this one, but this is in the form of a letter by an old woman to a real or imaginary brother. There's no way of being quite sure. But obviously this is one of the last few things that she has to depend on, is her feeling about this figment or person. She never did get away, and this is obviously one of the ways that she rationalizes her feeling of having been cheated. I don't think I need say any more than that, except that I don't have a sister named Gussie, and the title is a letter from Gussie, and I've been asked that. If our father were alive, the stains would not be defiling the walls, nor the splintery porch be supported mostly by ants. The garden gone to the bad, though that was purely mother's, would not have poked through the broken window like an arm, and you would never have dared behave toward me in this manner like no gentleman and no brother, not even a card at Christmas last Christmas. And once again, where are my dividends? This is my reward for remaining with our mother, who always took your part, you and your investments, with what she made me give you. Don't you think I'd have liked to get away also? I had the brochures ready and some nice things that fitted. After all, it isn't as though you'd ever married. Oh, and the plumbing, if I may say so, would not have just lain down, and the school children would not keep drilling the teeth, which I no longer have, with their voices. And each time I go out with a mouthful of clothespins, the pits of the hoodlums would not be dug nearer to the back steps. Maybe you think my patience endures forever. Maybe you think I will die. The goat, if you recall, I mentioned, had for a while died. And mother's canary, I won't pretend I was sorry. Maybe you want me to think you've died yourself, but I have my information. I've told some people of consequence, so anything can happen. Don't say I didn't warn you. I've looked long enough on the bright side, and now I'm telling you I won't stir from mother's chair until I get an answer. Morning, noon, and night can come and go as they please, and the man from the funeral parlor to change the calendars. But I won't go to bed at all unless they come and make me, and they'll have to bend me flat before they can put me away. I'm going to read several poems, one of which I hear has been published. I've been traveling around and I didn't know this, has apparently just been published, but they're all roughly about the same thing, about a recognition of circumstances and the fact that they no longer are possible, that they're completely foreign, and that one either has to succumb to them or change them or move from them. And in these cases, in all three cases, there's no question of changing them. They have to be moved from. They're in different ways ironic, all three of them, and I don't think I need to say any more than that. But I'll start with them, and I'll do them not in chronological order, but in order of gentleness or some strange thing like that. The first is called Views from the High Camp. It's called that, camp being deliberately a word suggesting impermanence, but also because the place that I had in mind was a place where a camp had been pitched for some months before a decisive battle in Europe. This isn't a necessary bit of information. The impermanence is quite enough. But it's a camp looking down into a plain and obviously off to a distance because of its height. In the afternoon, while the wind lies down in its halcyon self, a finger of darkness moving like an oar follows me through the blinding fields. In the focus of its peculiar radiance, I have found treasures I did not know I had lost, several perhaps still in the future. Among them, this epitaph for someone. Discoverer of absences, beloved lamp, you that wait. I have migrated from these footsteps, I alone, my own soul generation. Later loss will wake like the drowsing birds and have no word. Here we have watched the great yellow days turning their spokes toward autumn and departure, through month after month of drought, while daily the sun has hoisted a long cloud of decision and hung it in my sight at no distance, in the form of a tent full of wind, each cord wrenched in turn. Be assured that the rain will be released when it is too late to save the harvest. The second of these, which is the same kind of landscape, the same kind of situation, and the same kind of, I think, emotion, is called Foreign Summer. But it's much, the difference is one of light and dryness and so forth, and an image of darkness and coming to see things. out of. The night withdraws from behind the fog as an eye from behind a cataract. In time, the blindness itself withdraws, and there are the little fields drying like the laundry of strangers. Foreign summer, I came to you offering a sightless coin, but my own, holding it before me like a lantern, and it is gone. And now, even in your discarded costumes, I can see that your nakedness was never mine. The day widens its revelation between us, showing the roads. And I take up my empty hand, which will be my torch this evening. As for you, if you go the way of what I gave you, you will note the bright leaves floating face upwards in the swollen lakes of November and pass by without recognition. Your new darkness knows the way. All along, its old friends will come forward to greet it. Beyond their embraces, you will go on and on, happily, with your hope growing like hunger at every turn, and the wrong key in your hand. The third of these poems, having made those remarks about the first two, I don't think I need to say any more about these, is the most ironic of the three, and it's called Acclimatization. It assumes that kind of bitterness which precedes either disintegration or decision, or both. I entered at the top of my voice, I forget the song. In time it came over me that they were deaf. They gave me their praise and left me mute. I proceeded among them like a tourist liner among coin divers. I flung them what I had with me. Only then I saw that their smiles were made of gold, and their hands and their wives. They gave me their thanks and left me penniless. It was my fault. I got hungry, they fed me. I gave them my solemn word in payment, and all the bells in the city rang in triumph like cash registers. They gave me their credit and left me with little hope. When I woke, I discovered that they had taken my feet, leaving me the shoes. O priceless city, the buildings rising at dawn to grip the first light like bars, and the morning shattered with trees into all the shapes of heartbreak. I sit among them, smiling. But they demand, they demand, they demand. There is no putting them off. Theirs is the empire, and beyond the empire there is only ignorance where I could not survive without feet. To deceive them is to perish. What do I have that is my own? I offer my degradation as a blind beggar offers his palm, and I am given this glass eye to set in the place of tears. If those three poems presuppose some kind of meditation about departure, there's one which is about the actual moment of decision, which again invokes my grandfather, but less as a historical or dramatic figure this time, as a sort of vague ancestral figure who might be Father Adam, but in this case is handy because he's a pilot, or was a pilot, and found directions for something. The title is simply Sire. Here comes the shadow, not looking where it is going. And the whole night will fall. It is time. Here comes the little wind which the hour drags with it everywhere like an empty wagon through leaves. Here comes my ignorance shuffling after them, asking them what they are doing. Standing still, I can hear my footsteps come up behind me and go on ahead of me and come up behind me, and with different keys clinking in the pockets, and still I do not move. Here comes the white-haired thistle seed stumbling past through the branches like a paper lantern carried by a blind man. I believe it is the lost wisdom of my grandfather, whose ways were his own, and who died before I could ask. Forerunner, I would like to say, silent pilot, little dry death, future, your indirections are as strange to me as my own. I know so little that anything you might tell me would be a revelation. Sir, I would like to say, it is hard to think of the good woman presenting you with children like cakes, granting you the eye of her needle, standing in doorways, flinging after you little endearments like rocks, or her silence like a whole Sunday of bells. Instead, tell me, which of my many incomprehensions did you bequeath me, and where did they take you? Standing in the shoes of indecision, I hear them come up behind me and go on ahead of me, wearing boots, on crutches, barefoot. They could never get together on any doorsill or destination. The one with the assortment of smiles, the one jailed in himself like a forest, the one who comes back at evening drunk with despair and turns into the wrong night as though he owned it. Oh, small, deaf disappearance in the dusk. In which of their shoes will I find myself tomorrow? As all these poems are about the way you come at or come away from what you find yourself surrounded with and have got yourself surrounded with, I'm going to read three very short poems which are directly concerned with that. If I can find them. And they're all poems in prose. The third one is a deliberate parody of the sort of thing that you find in magazines like Popular Astrology and so on, you know, of what a particular astrological sign means. But it's done, well, I won't say anything about that. I don't think it needs to say any more than that. The first is very short, and they're each just a little bit longer than the other. First is called Savonarola. Unable to endure my world and calling the failure God, I will destroy yours. The second one is No Man's Goody. Wisdom, that dame with no age to act, wants all caprice for herself. She forgets herself and we see her naked. It is and it is not a surprise. And then she forgets herself again, and where was she? And we are left holding our unbegun actions like ears without rabbits. And the third, which is the mock astrological one, is called Lost Month. The light of the eyes in the house of the crow. Here the gods' voices break, and some will never sing again, but some come closer and whisper, never their names. There are no hinges. One side of the door is simply forgotten in the other. The seven-branched permission appears already lit unasked, but the wind is the wind of parsimony, and the shadows, which are numerous and large, strain at their slender leashes. One fine day, the first knives come through the mirrors like the fins of sharks. The images heal, but imperfectly. We keep discovering parts of ourselves which came to exist under this influential sign. To get back to this sort of main theme that we were sort of going through again, I'd like to read a poem that's about the length of the Gussie poem. About the decision. I mean, what the poems have been about indecision, and as I hope I said earlier, all of this junk about themes and about tying these things together are something that I discovered thinking back over them and wasn't aware of when I wrote them. And so I'm obviously making some sort of arbitrary arrangement, because if you're given a lot of tiddlywinks on the desk, you know, you have to make some sort of sense out of them. So I'm trying to make some kind of order as I go along, from indecision to decision or something like that. As those have been about the indecision that precedes departure, this is about some sort of necessary decision. It's called The Nails. I gave you sorrow to hang on your wall like a calendar in one color. I wear a torn place on my sleeve. It isn't as simple as that. Between no place of mine and no place of yours, you'd have thought I'd know the way by now just from thinking it over. Oh, I know I've no excuse to be stuck here turning like a mirror on a string, except it's hardly credible how it all keeps changing. Loss has a wider choice of directions than the other thing. As if I had a system, I shuffle among the lies, turning them over. If only I could be sure what I'd lost. I uncover my footprints. I poke them till the eyes open. They don't recall what it looked like. When was I using it last? Was it like a ring, or a light, or the autumn pond which chokes and glitters but grows colder? It could be all in the mind. Anyway, nothing seems to bring it back to me. And I've been to see your hands as trees borne away on a flood. The same film over and over, and an old one at that, shattering its account to the last of the digits and nothing and the blank end. The lightning has shown me the scars of the future. I've had a long look at someone alone like a key in a lock, without what it takes to turn. It isn't as simple as that. Winter will think back to your lit harvest for which there is no help, and the seed of eloquence will open its wings when you are gone. But at this moment, when the nails are kissing the fingers goodbye, and my only chance is bleeding from me, when my one chance is bleeding, for speaking either truth or comfort, I have no more tongue than a wound. For the last time to mention anything to do with my family, with whom I've not lived since I was 14. I mean, I seem to be harking back to them with sickening regularity. This one is one whom I never knew at all. A brother who was born and died within 15 minutes of his birth, 2 years before I was born. The family had it all worked out and simply told me about this at the age of about 5, and I thought you got upset when people died and couldn't understand that 7 years had elapsed and my family had got it taped. And this puzzled me and has continued to puzzle me as to what your exact relation is to a brother whom you never knew. This bepuzzlement, bemusement came out in some connection to the other poems that I've been writing last fall. The poem is simply called To My Brother Hansen, born January 28, 1926, died January 28, 1926. My elder, born into death like a message into a bottle, the tide keeps coming in empty on the only shore. Maybe it has lovers, but it has few friends. It is never still, but it keeps its counsel. And if I address you, whose curious stars climbed to the tops of their houses and froze, it is in hope of no answer, but as so often merely for want of another. For I have seen catastrophe taking root in the mirror, and why waste my words there? Yes, now the roads themselves are shattered as though they had fallen from a height, and the sky is cracked like varnish. Hard to believe, our family tree seems to be making its mark everywhere. I carry my head high on a pike that shall be nameless. Even so, we had to give up honor entirely, but I do what I can. I am patient with the woes of the cupboards, and God knows. I keep the good word close to hand like a ticket. I wake up at night on the penultimate stroke, and with my eyes still shut, I remember to turn the thorn in the breast of the bird of darkness. I listen to the painful song dropping away into sleep. Blood is supposed to be thicker. You were supposed to be there when the habits closed in, pushing their smiles in front of them, when I was filled with something else like a thermometer, when the moment of departure, standing on one leg like a sleeping stork by the doorway, put down the other foot and opened its eye. I got away this time, for a while. I've come again to the whetted edge of myself where I can hear the hollow waves breaking like bottles in the dark. What about it? Listen, I've had enough of this. Is there nobody else in the family to take care of the tree, to nurse the mirror, to fix up a bite for hope when the old thing comes to the door, to say to the pans of the balance, rise up and walk? I'm sort of within sight of the end, if you bear with me. Of the poems I plan to read, there are two more about some such departure having been made. The first one is called In the Night Fields. I heard the sparrows shouting, eat, eat, and then the day dragged its carcass in back of the hill. Slowly the tracks darkened. The smoke rose steadily from no fires. The old hunger left in the old darkness turned like a hanged knife. I would have preferred a quiet life. The bugs of regret began their services, using my spine as a rosary. I left the maps for the spiders. Let's go, I said. Light of the heart, the wheat had started lighting its lanterns, and in every house in heaven there were lights waving, hello, goodbye. But that's another life. Snug on the crumbling earth, the old bottles lay dreaming of new wine. I picked up my breast, which had gone out. By other lights I go looking for yours, through the standing harvest of my lost arrows. Under the moon, the shadow practices mowing. Not for me, I say. Please, not for my benefit. A man cannot live by bread alone. The sort of pair to that one is a poem which, instead of looking over a sort of landscape, looks over calendars or over time in some sense. It's an autumnal poem and looks back through a perspective of autumns. It's called October. I remember how I would say, I will gather these pieces together. Any minute now, I will make a knife out of a cloud. Even then, the days went leaving their wounds behind them, but monument, I kept saying to the grave, I am still your legend. There was another time when our hands met and the clock struck and we lived on the point of a needle like angels. I have seen the spider's triumph in the palm of my hand. Above my grave, that thoroughfare, there are words now that can bring my eyes to my feet, tamed. Beyond the trees wearing names that are not their own, the paths are growing like smoke. The promises have gone, 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 and they were here just now. There is the sky where they laid their fish. Soon it will be evening. The last poem which I wrote, which I've been running around all winter in a sort of silly way, and I haven't got any time to do any writing, is again about this same theme, but again from the other point of view. Departure is personified and spoken about as a person. And the title and the interlocutor of the poem is Departure's Girlfriend. Loneliness slept in the mirrors, but all week I kept them covered like cages. Then I thought of a better thing. And though it was late night in the city, there I was on my way to my boat, feeling good to be going, hugging this big wreath with the words like real silver, bon voyage. The night was mine, but everyone's, like a birthday. Its fur touched my face in passing. I was going down to my boat to see it off, and glad at the thought. Some leaves of the wreath were holding my hands, and the rest waved goodbye as I walked, as though they were still alive. And all went well till I came to the wharf, and no one. I say no one, but I mean there was this young man, maybe out of the merchant marine in some uniform, and I knew who he was. Just the same, when he said to me, "Where do you think you're going?" I was happy to tell him. But he said to me, "It isn't your boat. You don't have one." I said, "It's mine. I can prove it. Look at this wreath I'm carrying to it. Bon voyage." He said, "This is the Stone Wharf, lady. You don't own anything here." And as I was turning away, the injustice of it lit up the buildings, and there I was, in the other and hated city where I was born, where nothing is moored, where the lights crawl over the stone like flies, spelling now, now, and the same fat chances roll their many eyes. And I step once more through a hoop of tears and walk on holding this buoy of flowers in front of my beauty, wishing myself the good voyage. I'm going to end with one very short poem about writing, about the feeling that I've always had when I tried to write a poem, and whether I felt that I'd sort of written it or not, that it had got away. I should probably make a short ornithological note and say that the skylark, you've got one in the west which does virtually the same thing, and the European skylark, but there's none in the east of the United States that does this. They fly so high in open country that one skylark, which is about the size of a sparrow, can fill the whole plain as though it were amplified with a tremendous loudspeaker. And it's this very pure, clear two notes as though something were being shaken. And they sing on the wing at this height, which is very often so high that you can't see them, even with glasses. It's called the poem. Coming late, as always, I try to remember what I almost heard. The light avoids my eye. How many times have I heard the locks close and the lark take the keys and hang them in heaven?